Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Christian Studies. I'm your host, Ryan Shelton, and today I'm so pleased to be joined by George Southcombe, author of The Culture of Dissent in Restoration England, The Wonders of the Lord, published in 2019 by Boydell Press. Dr. Southcombe is the director of the Sarah Lawrence Program and a historian at Wadham College, Oxford. George, congratulations on the book, and welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you very much, Ryan. Great to be here.
Well, before we get into your wonderful book, The Culture of Dissent and Restoration England, I wonder, could you share a little bit about yourself?
Okay. I'm the director of the Sarah Lawrence Program in Wadham College in Oxford, which is one of the University of Oxford's visiting student programs. And alongside that, I work as a historian, predominantly of the 17th century. I've worked mainly on 17th century religion. I'm also in Sarah Lawrence associated with the Faculty of History there and the Faculty of Literature, and a lot of my work has been engaged in trying to think about the relationship between literature and history and theology.
Well, that's wonderful. So by way of background into this book that you've written, I wonder if you can help give us a little background into this period of the Restoration. Your book includes case studies of a Presbyterian, a General Baptist, a Quaker, a Fifth Monarchist, Independent, a particular Baptist, and we'll get into all those differences between these various dissenters and as we go along. But what happened with this Restoration that would have brought together such a diverse cast of figures into the same book?
Yeah, maybe in a sense, if I answer that by talking a bit about the book's genesis, I think, which sort of explains why I ended up in the late 17th century. In some ways, I think that the origins of the book can be sort of pinpointed bizarrely precisely, actually. I think it really has its origins in 1998, when I was speaking to my then undergraduate tutor, Nigel Smith, who's now a professor at Princeton, who'd done extraordinary work on Andrew Marvell. And I was thinking about writing an undergraduate thesis, and I said to Nigel, oh, I've got this idea. I thought I'd write something about the development of Foucault's thought in a particular way. And Nigel said, don't be stupid. You don't know anything about that. There's this man called Robert Everard, who is starts off as a General Baptist, is a political agitator related to those called the Levellers. And in the late 17th century, he becomes a Roman Catholic. Why don't you write about him? So I went away and said, okay, I'll write about him. I mean, Everard, in fact, doesn't then make it very much into this book, but that's the origins of this book, I think. Came from a period that I was really interested in as an undergraduate, which was the mid-17th century. It was the period of the Civil War. It was a period of the English Revolution. And I was particularly interested in the radical religious sects of that period and the people who were really covered by Christopher Hill's book, The World Turned Upside Down. That was kind of a touchstone for me. And I think in that original work on Everard, what I started to think about was what happens to these people after that mid-century revolution. What becomes of them in the late 17th century? So as your listeners, you know, may well know, what we have in England is it's 30th of January 1649, Charles I is executed, and at that point, England embarks on 11 years of kingless government. In 1660, that ends. The monarch returns, Charles II returns, and a whole series of questions are opened up about what England will then look like politically and religiously. During the period of civil war and revolution, a number of sort of radical religious groups have either come into being or have developed in number. So the Quakers, most famously, have actually come into being. Baptist numbers have grown dramatically. And come 1660, then there's a big question over what should be done about these groups. What should the religious situation in England be? Should it return to being a national church, which theoretically everyone should be a member of, Church of England, or should it allow any degree of toleration outside of that? And I think that's really what I became fascinated by, was the question of then how the members of these groups responded to that moment of 1660 and responded to what then occurred. And of course, what does occur in 1662 is the religious settlement is worked out and it's established that actually this isn't going to be a tolerationist society. This is a society which is going to re-establish an exclusionary Church of England, and it's going to leave a number of groups outside of it and technically proscribe them. And so much of what I became interested in is how these groups then deal with these questions of living in a persecutory society.
It's very interesting. Now, your first and largest chapter centers on a satirical Presbyterian poet named Robert Wilde. What a colorful chapter this one is. It was so many juicy quotes throughout. Now, he might be the dissenter who would be perhaps the least thrilled to have been grouped together with some of these other figures, but who was Robert Wilde, and what did the dramatic turn of events in 1660 and 1661 do to launch his literary profile?
Yeah, I think, as you say, the biggest chapter in this book is on Robert Wilde, and it really investigates Wilde as a member of a group that I haven't mentioned thus far, and that was the Presbyterians. Now, the Presbyterians in 1660 are in a very peculiar position. When we talk about Presbyterians in Restoration England, we tend not to mean, as we would earlier, those who are wedded necessarily to a specific Presbyterian form of church government. That's to say, by 1660, a number of Presbyterians have accepted that they could work within an episcopal system. So really what we're often using Presbyterian to mean is to talk about the heirs of those we would previously have called Puritans. And Wilde is my individual who I investigate within that tradition. So in some ways he's coming out of a Puritan tradition. And the Presbyterian position in 1660 is really quite different, I think, from that of a number of the other groups. I mean, for the Quakers, for the Baptists, the question really is whether they're going to be tolerated, whether they might be allowed to continue to worship outside of the national church. The Presbyterian position is different. The Presbyterians are interested from 1660 to 1662, and indeed thereafter, in whether they might be in some ways comprehended within the Church of England. That's to say, whether they actually still could play a role within the Church of England. And much of the negotiation from 1660 to 62 is about whether the Presbyterians are going to be given a place within this church. And what ultimately happens in 1662 is the passing of legislation, the Act of Uniformity, which in fact thrusts a number of them outside of this church. Around 2,000 ministers by 1662 lose their positions within the church. They're excluded from it. And most of those we would think of as Presbyterians. So I then use Robert Wilde in part to investigate, really, the Presbyterian identity. And while he was a Presbyterian minister, there are lots of things about him which are then peculiar. And one of those things is, as you say, that he actually writes a large amount of satirical verse. And the satire that Robert Wilde engages in is again very outside of what we have stereotypically come to think of as a Puritan tradition. Wilde's verse is frequently scatological. It's very robust. It's frequently engaged in very sort of direct ad hominem attacks. And so I wanted to use Wilde's example really to explore how the Presbyterians continued in part, or how one of the Presbyterians in a very public way continued to try to engage with the religious authorities of England. And I wanted also to think about how Presbyterian identity itself came to be formed. So how did this group, who in the early Stuart Church, we would have thought of the Puritan tradition as a part of the Church of England, very fundamentally embedded within it under James. How did that tradition start to form into a distinct identity outside of a church? And I tried to use an analysis of Wilde's poetry as a way of thinking about some of those questions. So one of the things that I suggest is that that what Robert Wilde's poetry provides is a set of materials which Presbyterians can laugh at together. And I suggest that partly that process of laughing together is what then starts actually to help form a particular kind of Presbyterian identity.
That's right. One of the themes that runs throughout this chapter on Wilde is the paradox of Restoration Presbyterians, a paradox that Wilde himself seems to embody. He's constantly having to pitch himself as a loyalist while dissenting and in favor of a national church, while an opponent of toleration and holding conventicles. I mean, so much interest there. But yeah, even I loved how you end this chapter with his immediate memory being a paradox. By the turn of the century, it seems that people couldn't reconcile his popularity with his Presbyterianism. Could you unpack this paradox of the Presbyterian position and Wilde's legacy?
I mean, I think that's absolutely right. By the time we get into the 18th century, the Presbyterians themselves are trying to forget people like Robert Wilde. And actually, I think that's had a much longer term historiographical impact, actually. I think a lot of our stereotype today of the Puritan in general is of the Puritan killjoy. It's the Puritan who is, in general, hypocritical and is also, loathes all forms of fun. I mean, that classic definition, the suspicion that somebody somewhere might be having fun. And that's a stereotype of the Puritan, which is partly forged by their enemies. But one of the things that I want to suggest is it's also forged within the Presbyterian tradition itself. And that's really, I think, what happens to Robert Wilde, is that once we get into the 18th century, if you like, toleration has been achieved. And what the Presbyterians are doing is to announce themselves in part what they're highlighting, I suppose, is their kind of serious intellectual credentials and the seriousness of their ministry. And in those terms, they engage, I think, in a kind of sanitizing exercise where they remove the people like wild sort of satire from their history. That all starts to look a bit antagonistic. It all starts to look a bit uncontrolled in some ways. And so by the time we get into the 18th century, when people write about Wilde, if they write about him at all, they emphasize his godly credentials. They emphasize him as a giver of sermons. They say remarkably little about him as a satirical poet.
Mm. Well, the next case study in your book features the Lincolnshire General Baptist Thomas Grantham. And unlike Wilde, Grantham seems a little less interested in mincing words or amusing his readers. He seems quite sincere. Not that Wilde wasn't sincere, but quite plain spoken in his style. What does Grantham's style contribute to this print culture of dissenting religion?
So Grantham, I think you're right, starts off certainly as a very direct and very robust critic of the Restored Church of England. Yeah. And that comes through very strongly in his early work. He writes a poem called The Prisoner Against the Prelate, in which he, in essence, associates the Church of England with the Whore of Babylon. And it, as you say, in terms of directiveness, that's as direct as it gets. I mean, just as a side note, that poem is fascinating in itself. I think it's in many ways, it's a kind of early example of the alien sends a postcard home genre, in that one of the things that Grantham does in it is he imagines going to an Anglican service, but as someone who has no idea what's going on, and he describes it purely in terms of what the people seem to be doing. He says things very strange. You know, these two men wander up and down, and then they stop and they bow at this wooden board, and what it means, I've no idea. So it's got its own satirical edge, but it's very, very robust its attack on the Church of England. I suppose what interested me then about Grantham is to a degree the movement you get in his life story from that early direct style to actually by the end of his life, the opening up of dialogues with a number actually within the Church of England and the forging of some kind of bonds of mutual respect. And by the time we get to the end of his life, he's actually, I think, developed quite strong links, perhaps even in friendships with some within the Church of England. So I think one of the things that interests me about Grantham was trying to tell that story of how over the Restoration you get a move from in terms of how someone is thinking about his position within the religious landscape. And how he's moving perhaps to a kind of more ameliorative position, really, by the end of his life.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, that you when you note kind of that change in Grantham, one of the themes that I found really interesting there, which I'm curious if you could unpack a little, it seems that one of the things that Grantham that allows for some of these friendships or some of his this kind of erratic disposition was a growing kind of anti-Calvinism within the Restoration Church. Is that Do you think that that's part of what caused Grantham in particular, as a general Baptist, to find that maybe he shared something in common with these anti-Puritans?
Yeah, I think, I mean, that is, it's certainly, it's an argument I want to make. And it does seem to me, if we're looking for one of the keys which might explain why it is that a general Baptist can come to start to engage in dialogues with someone within the Church of England, I think there is that kind of a possibility, at least, of sharing ideas about salvation. And on that level, I mean, people have talked about this and have talked about it often in relation to the late Elizabethan and early Stuart Church. People have often talked about how Puritans, because they can share in an overall Calvinist perspective on salvation with another within the church, are, despite their criticisms of the church, able to, in that case, remain within it. Mm-hmm. Now, Grantham obviously has no interest in becoming a member of the Church of England. Right. But I think a similar level of explanation is probably right in terms of interpreting how he's able to come to have these dialogues with those within the Church of England. And I think a certain amount of that comes out of a shared set of ideas about salvation. But rather than the sort of Calvinism that we see with Puritanism and in the Church of England under Elizabeth and James, it's in fact the anti-Calvinism which can act as that kind of binding force. And I think that's part of it. I mean, I would add to that as well, I think that one of the things which it seems to me which is in many ways very pervasive, but is almost so pervasive that we don't notice it, is the broader language of charity, is the Christ's injunction, love thy neighbour as thyself. And I think that is such a kind of powerful requirement that opens up some of the parameters again in which these dialogues can take place. Is that that's they often, when writing against each other, they will, I mean, Grantham towards the end of his life engages in a dispute with a Church of England minister called John Connold. And in many ways that dispute is quite fraught, and in many ways they remain profoundly divided on some key questions. But they also will relatively often sort of sign off to each other, I remain in charity with you. And the temptation is obviously just to write that off and say, oh, well, that's just, that's just convention. But actually, I think there's a danger in that. I think actually what is a convention actually probably has a deeper power for these men there.
Well, one of Grantham's sparring partners, who conveniently normalized some of his theological extremes, or at least created the comparison with himself that he wanted, was the Quaker John Whited, who's the subject of your third chapter. So one of the themes that comes up in this chapter addresses this question in the literature about continuity and discontinuity between pre and post-Restoration Quakerism. What's at stake with that kind of a historiographical debate?
Yeah, so I think the Quakers, in terms of previous historians who have been interested in this question of what changed in the Restoration, the Quakers have had a particular historiography there. And in a lot of ways, and it's quite a crude caricature, it's quite interesting in a sense when you reread it, you find that actually most of the people expressing these views weren't quite as crude as this, but the kind of caricature of that historiography is the Quakers are born in civil war, they're born in a moment of extraordinary radicalism, the inner light theology that they espouse legitimates extraordinary radical action. Come the Restoration, they have this powerful experience of defeat. They announce the peace principle, so they announce the principle of pacifism, of peace in all circumstances, and in essence they withdraw into themselves and live lives of kind of internal spiritual quietude. And that, as I say, that's the kind of how the Quakers in broad terms were often written about. So in terms of what I was interested in, the Restoration for the Quakers was probably of all groups seen as the most transformative moment. And I suppose one of the things I wanted to do was to use John Whitehead's example to test that a bit and to suggest that actually we do see some quite striking continuities in Quaker behaviour and Quaker activism across the boundary of 1660, and that if there is a major transformation in the movement, actually it comes later. Now, I should say that that chapter, I think, in particular, certainly I wanted to make the argument, as I say, for kind of continuity in Quaker political activism. I think you've had her on your podcast, but I think my old doctoral student, Madeline Pennington, her new book, I think that takes that question actually to a completely different level of sophistication. I think we have a kind of broad, we absolutely have a broad agreement on, in essence, what's happening. But Madeline's level of explanation for what is happening is of an entirely, more developed kind than the one that I offer, really. And so, partly I would actually point anyone particularly interested in Quaker transformation in that direction.
Now, your last major chapter I found really artful with an unexpected juxtaposition of the fifth monarchist, Vavasor Powell, and the particular Baptist, Benjamin Keach. It was a very interesting pairing, even though these two figures are often treated very differently in the literature. So, could you talk a little bit about the shared apocalypticism that united these two, and what that tells us about popular Reformation or popular Reformed theology during the Restoration period?
Yeah, I mean, so you're right that I wanted to pair them together because they've been treated previously really quite differently. So Vavasor Powell has been treated as, and in many ways quite rightly, as a leading fifth monarchist thinker. So the fifth monarchists were those who not only believed that Christ would rule for 1,000 years with his saints, or that the saints would rule for 1,000 years and then Christ would arrive. There's some sort of debate over that specific point. But they not only believed that, they also believed that they could do things to make that happen, to prepare the ground for Christ coming in the here and now. And Powell is often being written about in many ways as emblematic of that tradition, which is in some ways is fairly obviously a profoundly radical political tradition. Benjamin Keach has far more generally been written about as a serious theologian within the particular Baptist tradition, which he was, as the developer of a significant Baptist hymn tradition. And in many ways, much of the focus on Keach has been on his ministry and on his pastoral ministry and on his theology. And what I wanted to do was to bring them together and to use the example of each in some ways to challenge that historiography. So I wanted to say, on the one hand, that Vavasor Powell actually needs to be understood as a tremendously vigorous pastoral minister and someone who, once he ends up imprisoned in the Restoration, uses print to continue his pastoral ministry. And I also wanted to say of Keach that while his ministry was tremendously important, he also continued this line of extraordinary apocalyptic thinking, which reaches an absolute apogee for him with the coming of William of Orange, the coming of William III, which he writes about in intense millenarian terms and sort of announces his coming within an entire apocalyptic framework. And I suppose one of the things I was trying to do was to explain why the position of dissenters became so complicated in the Restoration. And it was partly because they had this possibility of dual identities, where you had someone like Keach, someone who was a very popular writer on theological issues, somebody who poured a lot of time into producing texts, particularly for the education of the young, and at the same time, someone who saw the world through an intense apocalyptic, with an intensely apocalyptic vision. And you, so you look, I mean, if you imagine coming across a man like Benjamin Keach, you are coming across someone who you think on the one hand is potentially doing valuable educational work, and on the other hand has an intensely radical political theology. And I think that helps to explain a lot of the ways in which you can both find people willing to open up dialogues with dissenters, and you also find people in extraordinary fear of them. I mean, just finally coming back, I think the final part of your question asked about Keach as a popularizer, really, of theology. And that does seem to me a very interesting aspect of Keach's work. So Keach writes a few kind of epic poems, really, in which he attempts to weave particular stories in verse, but as ways of talking in quite a lot of detail about fine points of Reformed theology. And so one of the things I think that Keach does is to provide in Restoration England kind of accessible texts within the Reformed tradition. And once you look at Keach's sales figures, and if you want to look at the number of editions his works go through, it's very clear that he is not only being read by other people within his religious tradition. It actually becomes very clear that in some ways, I think Keach is one of the most, is a significant voice within the Reformed tradition and someone who is disseminating that tradition in accessible ways throughout the Restoration period. And I suppose if you put that together with something we talked about earlier, i.e. the anti-Calvinism within a number of ministers within the Church of England. I think in part, if we think about who is it keeping the Reformed tradition going in Restoration England, yes, certainly we can find some Anglican ministers doing that. But also we have the particular Baptist tradition, which is reaching a far wider audience than simply other particular Baptists.
Well, we've covered this wide range of figures in these case studies that you've chosen to show this landscape of dissenting religion. So I wonder if we look at the landscape as a whole, what are some of the big picture takeaways that we can draw from what the culture of dissent in Restoration England was?
I think if we want to think in general terms, and I think in general terms about some of the things which the book demonstrates, I think there's a significant point and a very obvious one about the continued importance of print and print culture. And I say that that's obvious, and I think it is. I think probably in recent years we've become very used to writing about and thinking about the continued significance of manuscript culture. And I think that's really important. I think that certainly is the case. And I'm thinking there, I suppose, of work by people like Harold Love on scribal publication. But I think we shouldn't lose sight of the ways in which print could provide a really powerful mechanism for disseminating views in the late 17th century, and particularly for disseminating the views of those who are outside of the religious mainstream. And so I think that's one of the big things which comes through. I think the other thing which comes through is really the point that I touched upon before in talking about Benjamin Keach, but is that sense of the potential dual identities of dissent. So how you can have those who are seen on the one hand to be potentially providing important and in some kind of general sense as important Christian works within the society, at the same time as potentially representing a political tradition, which if we think about late Restoration, or if we think about Restoration England as being the time in which political parties come into being, for the Tories, dissent, you know, represents everything that they are frightened of. And I think it's actually quite significant that the Tories aren't just making that up. I mean, certainly they're stereotyping, but they're not just fabricating this. They are actually talking about groups whose political understanding is really fundamentally different from theirs. And so I think that way in which you have the kind of pastoral and political traditions running together helps to explain a lot of why the issue of dissent remains so controversial in this period.
Yeah, I loved the, I think it was in your chapter on Robert Wilde, that he had an afterlife as a Whig, a Whig poet that he you couldn't have hardly imagined at the time, but his satirical verse helped them build their identity.
Yeah.
So more, there's plenty more in the book that we haven't covered that I hope people can go pick up their copy of The Culture of Dissent in Restoration England. Now, George, now that this project is over, what are you working on next?
So I'm looking at, I suppose, two things. I've got a discrete project, which I'm completing with my friend Alexandra Guider, who's at Jesus College in Oxford, and we're reinvestigating together the origins of the 1563 witchcraft statute in England, and we're trying to locate the development of that statute in broader debates about church and state in the mid-16th century. So that's one thing. And then the larger sort of ongoing thing, and this, I think, really was sparked, I suppose, particularly by the work I did on Wilde, but then the broader interest I developed in satire. So I'm just embarking on a much larger project on a history of laughter and an attempt to track really changes in what people laughed at, how laughter was thought about, and how that might have shifted over the early modern period.
Well, that sounds like a absolutely fascinating project. I can't wait to follow the development of it, and maybe we can have you back on whenever that comes to press. Well, George, thank you so much for the generosity of your time to come and speak with us. The book is The Culture of Dissent in Restoration England, The Wonders of the Lord. You can get your copy now from Boydell Press. George, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ryan.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning into this episode of the New Books Network. You can visit newbooksnetwork.com, where you can find over 10,000 episodes on books ranging in any interest that you might have. That's it for now. I hope you have a great day.